In old school games where life is cheap, don't be a dope, grab your pole or the rope, or else you might go down in a heap.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Down in a Heap podcast. I'm your host Rob, podcasting to you live from beautiful Northeast Minneapolis. It's been a little bit of a gap here since my last episode. I guess I've been distracted by baseball. You know, I love baseball. But it's more that I just haven't thought up a good topic to that I was really very enthusiastic to podcast about. But I do have some messages, one from the person you heard at the top of the show, Rotten Free Thrall from the BX Pistols, doing his rendition of my theme song. Thanks for that, Spencer. Appreciate it. But I've got a message from Spencer and a message from Jason from Nerds RPG Variety Cast, both regarding to some of my last episodes. But I did, I've sometimes thought about doing a series on a series on some roleplay game supplements that came out in the early 80s. And they were the precursor to what became the Arcanum series, the Atlantean trilogy by Bard Games. And these first three supplements, the Complete Alchemist, the Complete Spellcaster, and the Complete Adventurer, were meant to be almost like surrogates for the class system, and in some cases the spell system, for your D&D game. So they were just really providing different options and stuff. And I thought, I should really go back through some of these. Now, I don't have the Complete Alchemist. Keith had that. And I think you can probably find a PDF of it online pretty easily. But, and I don't know, maybe if I really get into this, I'll try and track that down. But I'm going to start out by doing a deep dive into the Complete Adventurer. Is this old supplement, is it going in a direction that, I don't know, that meets my, scratches the itch I'm looking for more than, say, like, the class options in OSE Advanced or what was ever presented by the old games? I mean, do they do something like the Ranger better than the Ranger? Do they do something like the Barbarian or Gasp the Thief better than the original rules? Well, we'll take a look and see. But first, let's hear from my callers. First on deck is Spencer, a.k.a. Free Thrall from the Keep Off the Borderlands podcast. Take it away, Spencer.
Hey, Rob. Spencer here. I really appreciated hearing your thoughts regarding Cairn. Far be it from me to speak on your highest behalf, but I think it's the intent and the order in which the support for this game developed that kind of leaves the book maybe feeling a little on the light side. I know these rules were originally put together because Yochai wanted to use Into the Odd to run something a bit more like Dolmenwood. And I think he wanted to just get the rules out there, and they sort of precede quite a lot of the online stuff that developed around it. You know, they've always been free and you only pay for the price of printing, and then they direct you to even more free online content, which I think is where most of the more useful stuff is. And in some respects, I think Yochai was being quite smart here in considering the long game, because a lot more people seem to be aware of Cairn now than, say, something like Into the Odd. It's being spoken about by quite a lot of content creators as a way to move on from 5e and into more OSR style play. And, you know, I don't really want to get into how accurate that statement is, but I do hear it mentioned far more often than, say, something like Knave is, which to me seems like a much better fit for people from a 5e background. As you say, the Cairn 2e playtest is currently freely available too and has just been updated. It does address a lot of what appears to be absent from the first edition. It has a lot more flavour for one thing, and there's a lot more differentiation between the professions, which also come with potential adventure hooks sort of built in to the character creation process. And it definitely has more a sense of its own setting. With the Kickstarter launching in March and the interest already generated for the game, I imagine it's going to do rather well. This strikes me as the same approach that was taken by Mothership, hugely successful indie game. So yeah, that's why I think the Cairn book does seem to be a little bit on the light side, because looking at it in that kind of respect, it's more like a quick starter than anything else. Maybe I'm being charitable here, but I do think the book makes more sense considering it in that context. These are just my thoughts, obviously. I could be way off, and I'm certainly biased as I'm a big fan, and I'll certainly be backing the Kickstarter. I may have mentioned this before, but I do wonder if Mythic Bastion Land, with its slightly tweaked combat, might be worth taking a look at as well. But yeah, really enjoyed the episode. Take care.
Hey, thanks for the call, Spencer. I appreciate it. And I also appreciate you sharing your insights on how Cairn was developed, or at least this is your understanding of how it was developed, how it's changed and evolved and going into this second E Kickstarter and stuff. And maybe looking at it, at least the actual booklet, as a quick starter is probably the best viewpoint to have of it. Now, that said, I get that it's just a quick starter, but and that kind of explains some of my or deals with some of my gripes about it. The whole like content choices for a very limited space. It doesn't address the fact that there's space that's just unused in the booklet. And it also doesn't address really my major beefs with the game. That it's the armor system doesn't really make sense. That the encumbrance system that he adapted from Knave doesn't make a whole lot of sense, because strength has no bearing on it. Your character's strength score. And some items like the cart and the mule make zero sense in how it's handled for slots and stuff. And then that the PC advancement, and this is a problem I have with Electric Bastion Land too, is almost entirely random. It's just getting into combat and being reduced to exactly zero hit points and in how many points of damage you took to get to that point determines what happens. And that it absolutely requires you to be in combat. There's no way to advance your character except by being in combat. So I just don't like those design choices. And that's why I prefer Into the Odd and or Knave to Cairn. Now, I applaud Yohigal for the fact that this is pretty much free. Like you said, it's just the cost of printing and shipping. So it's, you know, $5 or something. And that there's all kinds of free content on his website that maybe address some of the problems I have with it. I haven't delved into it. But yeah, and why it has gotten so much exposure is beyond me. I don't understand the nuances of social media and how some things become popular while others don't. I think a lot of it is just luck. A lot of it is just someone that's real, that themselves have somehow become very popular, talks about it, and then it gets on the radar of other people via that, so it becomes this viral kind of thing. And as you point out, Karen did get a lot of pub from some of the some big YouTubers when WotC whizzed it down their leg in the whole OGL fiasco, and they started saying that Karen was a good indie option for people that were dissatisfied with WotC or growing tired of 5e or something like that. And like you, again, I don't understand why Karen would be a good choice for people like that, but to me, that's a much bigger gap or a bigger leap to make to going from 5e to Karen than just going from 5e to some OSR game, or like Shadow Dark, I think would be the natural step away from 5e for 5e enthusiasts. And I certainly think that Into the Odd and Knave are both better presentations of this kind of stripped down rule set than Karen. But yeah, for whatever reason, it's got its enthusiasts, and if those people are having a great time with it, go for it. And as you point out, the second edition Kickstarter, I haven't followed along, but it sounds like it's going to be launching sometime soon here if it hasn't already. And I wish him success and hope it delivers the type of game that everyone's hoping for. It's funny you mentioned the Mothership, and that, you know, it's that big Kickstarter, which I think netted like $1 million or something. I think it's like 2 years late. And I don't know. I think I'm just done with Kickstarter. I think I've backed 4 things, including Mythic Bastion Land, and that's, I just got an update from Chris McDowell about it yesterday, saying that it's on track, and I think it's supposed to be released sometime this summer. But I've got a bunch of other Kickstarters that are all late. Aside from Gavin Norman, with Old School Essentials and the things he does, he always seems to be on time. And Jeffrey Jones, who does like the Gary's Appendix and other games. Those are the only two people that seem to be reliably on time that I've backed. Everyone else, late. And I'm just tired of everyone being late. And I'm tired of this being more of a pre-order process where you don't really save any money because it ends up being on drive-through later anyway, or it ends up on the shelf of my local game store and I don't have to pay any shipping fees, and I get a 10% discount for being in their Adventure Club membership and stuff anyway. So, yeah, I think I'm just done with Kickstarter. And for anyone that does Kickstarter, just add 6 months to whatever you truly believe in your heart is going to be the fulfillment date, because something always comes up. It's just, Kickstarter, blah. I'm done with it. Well, thanks for the call, Spencer, and let's move on to Jason from Nerds RPG Variety Cast. He's called in about my review of The Big Wet.
Welcome to the Penthouse, Thundar.
Hey, Rob, Jason here. Just want to say enjoyed your review of The Big Wet. You know, the first thing that came to me was Rucker Hauer's wonderful movie, Split Second. So, Split Second, not everybody's cup of tea, but I really enjoy it, and it gives you this kind of environment, what they're talking about there. Of course, that one's set in London, but it's almost a perfect match for what you're talking about there. Although society hadn't totally collapsed, you know, you're not down to bullets for currency in Split Second, but I think you could, yeah. So it's kind of post-apocalyptic the way Mad Max is. So it's not post-apocalyptic, it's pre-apoc. It's like the prelude to the apocalypse, right? But yeah. Anyhow, interesting. I don't know. These days, I'm not into downer post-apocalyptic stuff. I'm more into things like Platium's After the Bomb, which is more hopeful setting. But I appreciate you reviewing it, and I look forward to what you do next.
Hey, Jason, thanks for the call. I appreciate it, as always. I totally get what you're saying about not being into downer post-apocalyptic games anymore. It's funny how it seems like post-apoc games that I've seen or heard about or whatever, they fall on the extremes. They're either super gonzo, like Gamma World, or Mutants of Ix, or Mutant Crawl Classics, or they're super hyper-realistic simulationist kind of things, like The Moral Project, or Aftermath, or well, I guess this The Big Wet post-Diluvian RPG. And I don't, maybe is Twilight 2000, do people consider that a post-apoc game? I don't know, but that falls in that camp too. I haven't run across one that seems like a happy medium, where you could have things like mutants, but they're not mutants that can breathe fire or or teleport or some crazy stuff like that. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know if one of the hyper-realistic post-apoc games is something that I'd really get into for a long time, or that my players would. I think that would be more likely to run dry more quickly than a gonzo one. And I think, you know, something like Thundar the Barbarian is probably what most people want to play in a post-apocalyptic kind of game. Those seem like they're the most popular types of games. So, yeah, I get what you're saying. And have a feeling that if we ever do play The Big Wet, it's going to be like maybe some little mini six-session game. And maybe it's something that we revisit if people really had a good time, or there's, you know, not everyone can show up one week or something like that. But in all likelihood, it won't even get to the table, because I think the guys I game with are much more into fantasy, classic fantasy games, than they are in sci-fi or westerns or post-apoc and all that. So, and that Rucker Hauer movie, Split Second, I haven't seen it, but sounds like I better check it out. All right, thanks for the call, and now time to move on to the main topic of the podcast, The Complete Adventurer. Boom, boom, boom. All right, as I mentioned, this was a trilogy that was released back in the early 80s by Bard Games. The Complete Alchemist is what I think was released first, or what I saw on the shelf first, then The Complete Spellcaster, and then The Complete Adventurer. And I have no idea if that was the actual publication history. It's just what I saw on the shelves. And these were, I think, aimed more at like AD&D players. I think when you are looking at the contents of this, there's far more AD&D-isms than BX-isms, if that makes any sense. But it's very much a kind of amateur production. This was, from my understanding, the first foray into the field by Stephen Michael Secchi. I don't know if that's how you pronounce it. I apologize if I'm mispronouncing it. S-E-C-H-I, but Stephen Michael Secchi is the brain, or seems to be the main person behind Bard Games. And they, as I said earlier, went on to produce the Atlantean trilogy and then Talos Lanta. So this is like the beginnings of the evolution. And these were marketed towards AD&D players looking for different options. And these were released in 1983. So a couple of years before Unearthed Arcana came out. And it's, yeah, so this was, and if you're ever, if you're doing a search for this, and you can find PDFs of this, it's The Complete Adventurer, and complete is spelled C-O-M-P-L-E-A-T, and likewise The Complete Alchemist and Complete Spellcaster are spelled that way. Cover art is Joe Boza, cover graphics Peter Blandori, illustrations Joe Boza and Stephen Michael Secchi, layout interior graphics, blah blah blah. It's interesting here. Thanks once again to Joel K, high level legal advisor. Andy Valley and Sons New England printers. It's interesting that this came out in a time where, from my understanding, TSR was quite litigious. And this came out before the OGL, before any kind of, you know, platform was out there for people to make these types of things as with a legal safe haven. And that's why I don't really, you know, like when people were so, people seem to be so worried about like WOTC trying to come down on them and stuff. This stuff has been going on since 1983. And apparently, Joel Kay, a high-level legal advisor, was savvy enough to know what could be prosecuted and copyright and what couldn't be. Because this definitely leans into D&D. I can't remember if I've actually seen if they actually refer to D&D. I think it just says, no, your favorite fantasy role-playing game system. So I don't, and you know, they don't use things like, they don't use the term dungeon master. They call it a game judge and stuff like that. But it's, yeah, it's interesting that these things were on the shelf. They were advertised in Dragon Magazine. I don't know, maybe there was some kind of payoff to TSR that who gave them the rights to do this. I have no idea, but it did go on. Other interesting thing is the price. This was $7.50, and this was at a time when the AD&D books were all $12 for the hardcovers, except the Dungeon Master's Guide, which was $15. So seven, if something was $12 and this was $7.50, that's the equivalent today. If you buy a 5th edition book at $50, that would put this at 31 and a quarter. So this was expensive back in the day, which is probably why I only had the one, and Keith had one, and Keith maybe had the complete spellcaster too, because now that I look back at it, my mom made a photocopy of the complete spellcaster for me and spiral bound it. So Keith probably loaned me the complete spellcaster. My mom photocopied it, and yeah, oops, admission of ne'er do well. of a crime, I guess, a $7.50 crime. So yeah, that's, this is a 42 page soft cover, with, mainly just like illustrations for each of the character classes. And the illustrations, it's very, you know, I'd say it's poor. It's not great illustration work. It's not much better than I could do, and I'm not a very good artist. So it's the type of thing where, yeah, my buddy can draw pretty well. It's the type of thing that you'd see, you know, a fairly talented person drawing a sketch of their character or something, right? And the layout and font is very much of its time. It would be probably the equivalent of today doing something just on a Word document with single column and 12-point font or something in a weird font that looks like it's off of a old Epson printer or something. Anyway, so this covers. Let's see. The complete adventure featuring rules for the Beastmaster, Buccaneer, Bounty Hunter, Gladiator, Harlequin, Knight, Martial Artist, Rogue, Scout, Spy, Swordsman, Warrior, and Witch Hunter as a player or non-player character adaptable to most fantasy role-playing games. And at the beginning, and I think they did this for the complete spellcaster too, there was, there's designer notes. So it's telling you who, what the inspiration was behind each of these classes. So, for instance, Beastmaster, a combination of Raiden's noble savage and the popular hero of many a fantasy epic, the Barbarian. Individuals who possess the power to influence animals can be found in the oldest myths and countless modern works of fiction and fantasy as well. Still, Edgar Rice Burroughs' Tarzan was perhaps the most main influence for this character. The Gladiator. This character is a combination of the Roman gladiator and the Greco-Roman boxers and wrestlers. All were exceptionally well-trained and very dangerous fighters at close quarters. As a not particularly successful high school wrestler, the author can verify just how fast a good wrestler is and how hard it is to escape from any well-executed hold. So, yeah, it's I like how it's got these little design notes and stuff. And then it has how to use this supplement. So this gives you information on how to adapt these character classes into a experience point level of ability system, so D&D, or a percentage ability system like BRP, or something that just uses statistics to resolve everything. So for instance, the Buccaneer saves as per thieves, all else as per fighters. That's the type of example. Harlequin as per thieves, knight as per fighters, etc., etc. Then it talks about the format of these classes. Each of the character classes in this supplement have been outlined under the following format: combat capabilities. This denotes the degree of skill which an average member of this class will possess with regard to the use of weapons. Each class will be given one of the following ratings: highly trained. Weapon use is the primary skill for this class. Trained. Weapon use is a secondary skill for this class. Untrained. No formal training with weapons. And then there's alignment, and this is one of the areas where it's a AD&Dism, because it's clearly assuming like a 9-point alignment system rather than the 3-point. It gives the races that can choose the class. Minimum attributes. And here's where they get away from the standard 6, in that they don't even mention intelligence in this. And instead of wisdom, they call it will. But they're, yeah, otherwise it's strength, dexterity, constitution, and charisma. So, yeah. And then saving throws. In this supplement, all saving throws or saves have been defined as a save versus a particular attribute, such as strength, intelligence. Oh, they do mention intelligence here, etc. All such... So I guess they just forgot to put intelligence, or maybe it was deliberate. That savvy, high-level legal mind, Joel K. All such saves are made by rolling a d20 against the attribute in question. If the die roll is less than or equal to the attribute in question, the save is successful. And they give a modified saving throw optional rule. Optionally, the game judge may modify any save according to the level of the character. Award plus modifiers based on the difference in levels between two combatants, or according to the degree of difficulty of a particular hazard or task. In the former example, a 5th-level martial artist attempting to dodge a spear that has been thrown by a 3rd-level character may be given a +2 on their required save versus dexterity. Conversely, if the 5th-level martial artist had to save versus the attack of a 7th-level antagonist, the martial artist would save at a penalty of -2. The formula for all such modified saves can be stated as defender's level minus attacker's level equals modifier. The game judge should also feel free to modify any saving throw based on the circumstances involved. Some walls are harder to climb than others, some locks harder to pick, some writings harder to decipher, etc. Now, if it was just the straight saving throw, just an attribute, I would not like this at all, because I think character level should matter as much as or more than attributes. But with this modified saving throw, This is fine. It could work. But otherwise, I don't like it when a first level character, just because they have a high attribute, is virtually immune to certain certain attacks because they have a 17 strength or something, whereas a 12 level fighter that has a 10 strength fails half the time. That doesn't make much sense to me, but this modified thing kind of mitigates that. Like a lot of players of the time, the people here at Bard Games seem to have been pretty dissatisfied with the the unarmed combat rules in AD&D because they present their own here. All characters and most types of humanoid creatures are capable of the weaponless combat techniques known as brawling and grappling. The following is a simple and fast-playing system of weaponless combat which may be adapted to most game systems. General rules. Unless characters have specific brawling or grappling skills, they must be considered as non-proficient in such forms of attacks. The usual attack roll should be employed to determine the initial success of any such maneuver, but the player must specify the exact type of maneuver being attempted prior to rolling any die. Brawling grappling maneuvers. Most brawling or grappling maneuvers fall under one of the following four categories. Attack. Punching, kicking, headbutt, forearm, smash, etc. A successful hit will do 1 to 3 points of damage plus strength bonuses where applicable. Number 2, restrain. Bear hug, headlock, arm lock, etc. Figure 4 leg lock, that's my my addition. A successful hit indicates that the victim has been grabbed. Roll a save versus strength for both the attacker and the defender once per round. If the attacker's save fails and the defender's save is successful, the defender breaks free. If not, the attacker maintains the restraining hold. Note that there should always be at least a 50-50 chance that the individual being restrained can try to escape by using a dagger or a dirty trick. See number 4. Number 3, knockdown. Tackling, shoving, tripping, etc. A successful hit indicates that contact has been made, but the intended target is allowed a save versus dexterity to avoid being knocked down. The game judge may award plus minus modifiers based on the attacker's or defender's size and or method being used to affect the attempted knockdown. Number 4, dirty tricks. Gouging, biting, applying a chokehold, striking or kicking a particular area of the body, below the belt, I'm assuming they mean, throwing substances at defenders' eyes, etc. Such specific hits must be made at a minimum penalty of minus 4 on the attack die. Damage is usually as per the attack maneuver, with blinding attempts having a 50-50 chance of accomplishing the desired effect. Check each eye. Wow. If the purpose of the dirty trick was to stun, shock, confuse, or cause a specific reaction from the victim, a save versus the appropriate attribute can be used to determine the victim's reaction. Note, brawling grappling is one example where the optional modified saving throw rules should not be used. Huh. This will keep added modifiers to a bare minimum and speed up play. Well, there you go. There's an optional brawling grappling rules for your OSR games. If you're not satisfied with ones that you currently employ, let me know what you think of them. And, well, it's almost 10 minutes. I think we've got time to... Oh, wait, 16 minutes. It's... we've got time maybe to review one or two classes here. And then we'll end this episode and have one or two more episodes doing a deep dive into this supplement. So I'm gonna go in not in reverse order, but the class I'm going to discuss first is kind of the baseline. It's the warrior. It's essentially like their version of the fighter. And you know, I don't think this supplement is all that. I think there's lots and lots of warts and lots of design decisions made that I am not particularly a fan of. But it's continuing kind of a tradition that was in AD&D, where some classes were clearly like a consolation prize, and the fighter was always a consolation prize. It's the class that you chose because you wanted to be a dwarf, or you wanted to be a half-orc, or whatever. or you just didn't roll good enough stats to be a ranger or a paladin, or you didn't want to be good or lawful good or whatever. So the fighter in AD&D was always a consolation prize, and the warrior here is the consolation prize. So combat capabilities, highly trained. So to me, that implies that you use the fighter attack tables from AD&D, and you probably give them a D8 or D10, I guess, in AD&D for hit points. Alignment, any. Race, any. Minimum attributes, strength of 10. Special abilities, see text. Restrictions, see text. Warriors are the most common of the fighter classes and can be found in most types of civilized and uncivilized cultures. As their training is general in nature, warriors have no restrictions with regard to the type of weapons and armors that they may use. Game judges should, however, take steps to ensure that any equipment that is available to warriors reflects the cultural and climatic conditions of the area in which they live. Warriors may initially be proficient in the use of any 3 weapons and may learn 1 new weapon for every 3 levels of ability. That's pretty close to what AD&D does, except AD&D had 4 weapons for a fighter. If a player warrior chooses, he or she may devote 2 weapon proficiencies to any single type of weapon, thus becoming a specialist in the use of that weapon. Warriors who specialize in a particular type of weapon always receive a bonus of +1 on the attack die when using that weapon. Note that warriors may not specialize in more than 2 different weapons. So, yeah, that's not, I mean, you get +1. Whoop-de-doo! And we'll see when we're talking about the other classes that are kind of like subclasses of the warrior, much like ranger and paladin, and later barbarian and cavalier are subclasses of the fighter in AD&D. All the subclasses are a lot better than the warrior. In addition to the usual number of secondary talents, which all characters may possess, warriors may choose to be proficient in any 3 of the following skill areas. And this is what really influenced my house ruling and game design and stuff in the future. These complete guides and later the Arcanum were big influences on me. And I love the fact that even though some of these things are really kind of off the wall, they allow you to make your particular fighter a little bit more flavorful, a little bit more unique than just the bog standard fighter. Are these the 6 things that I'd choose, or are they implemented in such a way that I think they're, I don't know, the mechanics make sense in the game and stuff? No, not necessarily, and I'd do it differently, but the idea behind it is something that I found very influential. So, the 6 different areas. Number 1, horsemanship. Warriors with this skill will know how to ride and handle a horse under combat conditions. All right. Number 2, basic seamanship. Warriors with this skill will know how to operate small oar or sail-driven craft. Okay. Number 3, street fighting. Warriors with this skill receive a bonus of +1 on any die roll required for brawling grappling maneuvers. All right, cool. Number 4, drinking. Drinking. Warriors with this skill, quote, it should be quote-unquote skill, receive a +1 bonus for any save versus constitution required for drinking alcoholic substances. Now, who'd choose that over some of these other things? I don't know, but it would be more for comic and role-playing, I think, than anything else. But it kind of gets at the weird, wacky nature, I suppose, of like adolescent boys who are a big segment of the game-playing audience then. Oh, I want to be a drinker. So, yeah, interesting. Number 5, siege. Warriors with siege experience will be familiar with the operation of any type of catapult, ballista, trebuchet, etc., and may choose to be proficient in any of these weapons. So, do you have to choose one of those? I don't know. Number 6, Command. Warriors with Command ability receive a +1 bonus for any save versus charisma required while in charge of any relatively small 2 to 20 group of fighters or laborers. So, again, these are not the best kind of things. Some of them, the drinking especially, is like of questionable worth. And I would have come up with a lot of other different options. In fact, I have in, you know, the games I've made and stuff. But this was like the kernel behind a lot of my thought processes. And whether or not it was done first by Bard Games or other RPGs, you know, someone can probably call in and tell me, oh, they did this in Tunnels and Trolls or something. I don't know. But this was the first place I saw it, or I remember seeing these discretionary kind of abilities for character classes. And I thought it was really cool at the time. I still think it's really cool. I think it's a way you can, frankly, get rid of a lot of other, what I see as superfluous classes. But, you know, the way they outline things in The Complete Adventure, to me, they're not quite as superfluous as they are in traditional D&D. They make a little bit more sense to me. And maybe it's just the way my brain works, but that's how I see it. And it wraps up by saying, warriors may seek employment in a variety of professions, including bodyguard, slaver, crewman, artillerist, mercenary, or conscripted soldier, etc. So there you have it. And this episode has gone on quite a while, so, you know, I'm going to wrap things up here with warrior as the baseline. And then when we return the next episode, I will start going through the other more interesting classes in alphabetical order. So we'll start out with, or at least how they roll through the book here, with the Beastmaster, with the Buccaneer, the Gladiator, and I'd probably be able to get at least 4 in, and the Harlequin. Is Harlequin a better or more clear type of class than the Bard? Is it just as worthless in Rob's mind as the Bard? Tune in to find out. So, thanks to Spencer and Jason for your calls today. Thanks for listening. And until I talk to you again, go Twins, go Bucks, and don't go down in a heap.